Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Coast to Coast, This Week in America. In one of America's most shocking criminal justice exoneration cases, for the first time, Keith Tyrone Bush gives his own account of his injustice and leaves us with the journey he traveled to make it back home. Unshackling the Truth, Triumphant Over Injustice tells the story of Keith, who endured over 44 years in the criminal justice system, with more than three decades spent in prison. Despite great adversity, Keith's determination for freedom, self-empowerment, now serves as an inspiration for others. Keith was born in Bridgeport, Connecticut in 1957, spent his early years between Bridgeport and Belport, Long Island in New York. At 17 years old, Keith was taken into police custody, held incommunicado, and physically forced to sign a confession. He was subsequently arrested, convicted, and sentenced to life imprisonment. Unshackling the Truth is a first-hand account of his ordeal and his journey to freedom. And Keith Tyrone Bush is our guest on This Week in America. Keith, welcome to the program. What a story you have to tell. Thank you for being with us on the program.
Well, thank you, Rick. Thank you for having me here, and I look forward to it.
This is such a remarkable story. The book, by the way, is available wherever books are sold. I'll give you that information and Keith's website as we go through the conversation. Let's start with why you decided to write this book. Why did you decide this? And it's a very important book. Why did you decide to write this?
Well, initially, I didn't decide in the initial stages. What I did is my attorney had asked me to write down the accounts of everything that happened from the night of the party until I was arrested. And, you know, I wrote that down, and before you know it, I was writing down other things, and then I started adding on to that as days went on, and eventually I started writing poetry. So writing became a part of my habits while I was in prison, and then I started just kind of accumulating all that information. And when I went through certain things in prison that I wrote down, and some of the tickets and all the other stuff I dealt with from my transfers to counselors, I started writing that stuff down. And before you know it, I was really, I had accumulated a lot of information about the trials and tribulations I was going through. So that became part of a habit. But I think the other thing too was there came a point during my incarceration when I didn't know if I would get out. I didn't know if I would free myself from, you know, this type of oppression. So I felt it was necessary for me to tell this story. So if I died in prison, then at least my version of the truth would be made manifested. And I thought that was essential because all of the facts, scientific facts and the newly discovered evidence and everything, was a part of my appeal process. They just was overlooked for so long.
What a remarkable story that Keith tells. It's his story, Unshackling the Truth, Triumphant Over Injustice. Keep in mind, in the beginning, I talked about in part of the judicial system, criminal justice system, for over four decades, over three decades spent in prison. Let's briefly go back to that event, 17 years old. Give us a chronological overview of what happened to you.
Well, Rick, it was a party. It was in North Belport, New York, teenage party. Teenagers ranged from 13 to 20, some was older. And in the community, there was most people were familiar with each other. You had some people that were coming from out of town, from different parts of the island. But I attended that party that night, and I interacted with people at the party. I also interacted with the deceased and friends. But 2 days later, the deceased was found, her body was found approximately 4 to 5 blocks away from the actual party. And as a result of that discovery, you know, there was a witness who allegedly came forward and made a claim that implicated me walking away from the party with the deceased. And because of that, according to detectives, I was considered a prime suspect. As a result of that, they had lured me into their possession, placed me in communicado, forced a confession, forced me to sign a statement that was a confession. And as a result of that, I just been in the county jail trying to figure out what was going on. My lawyer was interviewing witnesses. There was different accounts of the stories. And, you know, there's so much going on. It was very difficult to kind of pinpoint a lot of the factual parts of the story because of the contradictions in many of the accounts from prosecution and defense witnesses. But overall, I made the decision to go to trial, and I testified in my own defense. I testified to my claim of innocence, but I was convicted. And as a result of being convicted, I was sentenced to life imprisonment with a 20-year consideration for release. As a result of that conviction, I was sent upstate New York, and that's where I began this difficult journey.
When did you realize that you were not only a suspect, but the suspect? Was there a moment you remember when you realized, this is serious, they are building a case against me?
Well, I didn't realize that at the time of the investigation of the case, when they found the body. The community was concerned. We were all concerned and willing to help find out what took place and try to find out, you know, who did it. We had heard she had got into a car with some guys from Riverhead, a few towns over, and that's all we basically knew at the time. I didn't know I was a suspect. I never knew I was a suspect in this crime because I knew I had nothing to do with the crime, but I didn't know about the witness statement until I was basically in police custody. That's when I first learned about that. But this was just their claims of it. I never actually saw it for it to be validated. But that, I guess it was that statement that they considered me a suspect, and then they used that as a basis to close the case.
Did they put pressure on you to cop a plea of some kind and not go to trial? Did they point out that this would possibly be life imprisonment? If you cop a plea, you could get out in a number of years. Did they try to get you to offer a plea?
Yeah, they use a number of tactics.
Yes.
They use intimidation. They use the good guy, bad guy approach. There was promises that, we know you was young. This can happen to anybody. We can help you. You know, we can talk to the judge. You know, they were using every strategy that they could. Their whole objective was to put my signature on a piece of paper that they constructed to describe the way this crime was committed.
Talk about deciding to be your own witness, to testify at trial. They often say there's really no upside to that. It's all downside. Don't go ahead and get on the stand. What was your decision like? You're innocent. You want to go on and testify. Did your attorney go along with that initially, or was he reluctant?
Well, just actually during trial, they had offered me a plea bargain. And that plea bargain was, a manslaughter. And it was less than the time that I was required to do. But I made it clear to him that I wasn't going to admit to this crime and I wasn't going to take a plea bargain. But he knew that I was going to testify throughout the investigation of the case, and by me writing down all the things that I could remember, at that time. So he was fully aware that I was going to testify in this case, and there was no reason why I wasn't going to testify because my life was on the line.
Yes.
And I needed to be heard.
Keith Tyrone Bush is our guest on the program. His book is Unshackling the Truth, Triumphant Over Injustice. His website is unshacklingkeith.com. You'll find that when you go to our website, thisweekinamerica.us. Book available wherever books are sold. Talk a little bit about the key points that you raised after you were incarcerated. You're in there, you're wrongfully convicted. How did you go about building a case, which took years before you were finally able to convince somebody? How did you go about building the case? What were your key points, did you think?
Well, the whole thing about the building process is that, you're entitled to, at least in New York State, a direct appeal. And most of that information is going to come out of the records itself, you know. So it's a matter of finding an attorney to, look deep into these records and identify some of the key issues in there that can be raised, especially if these issues have constitutional dimension. And we basically kind of looked at the case. And at the time that I was in the appeal process, a case came out in New York State, and that case was Donaway versus New York. It came out of the United States Supreme Court. And ironically, that case had fit my case like a tailor suit, because all of the factors in Donaway was basically identical to mine. So the appellate division, they held my case in abeyance, and they sent me that back to the county jail for a hearing to determine if, at the time of my arrest, there was sufficient evidence to support probable cause, because they had determined that my presence at the police precinct was the result of police deception and trickery. So if there was sufficient evidence to support that, then that would support an illegal detention and thus establish probable cause. If not, then all of the physical evidence they acquired as a result of that legal detention would have to be thrown out, which would be the confession, the essential piece of evidence relied upon. We went into the county arguing, even with the prosecution's main witness, that there wasn't sufficient evidence to support probable cause. But ironically, the district attorney had paid to have this witness brought back from Alabama. She had moved out of Connecticut, out of Long Island as a result of the crime. And I guess people were, pressuring her, complaining, why was she lying at trial? And but she came back, and when she came back, instead of testifying for the prosecution, she admitted to him that she had lied against me at trial. And he had to turn that information over to me. So that was a very important piece of evidence that, really established the fact that there was no probable cause. But the appellate division, when the case went, the county jail, the county judge, he denied the probable cause hearing, and it went to the appellate division. They denied the probable cause hearing without no opinion. I had went back and did a collateral attack, and I challenged the recantation, on the facts that were determined by the trial judge, who felt that this young girl hadn't matured into a disturbed adult, but her disturbance couldn't be described. So he found that her testimony was unbelievable. But this young girl testified that at the time of trial, she was 15 years old, she was pregnant. And after she testified, after I got convicted, it began to bother her. She was home, crying, kind of going through these changes. She had a baby, and like 6 months later, she had a baby boy, and her baby died. I don't know if it was a crib death or whatever, but he died mysteriously. So she felt like God was punishing her for what she did to me. So eventually she had to seek psychiatric care. She tried to commit suicide. And I argued that, obviously her mental state in terms of how she developed is consistent with her testimony of the trauma that she also encountered from this false testimony, and that she needed to be examined by an expert in that field to make that fact finding, to assist the court in its fact finding determination on whether or not this testimony is reliable. But again, that was denied. I had did collateral attacks to the appellate division because I was trying to get into the federal courts after the appellate division and the Court of Appeals denied all my efforts to overturn my conviction, and 9 out of 10 was without opinion. But in order to get into the federal courts, I had mixed petitions. I had no, after I lost my state court, I didn't have an attorney no more because I couldn't afford an attorney. So at that time, I had to kind of do these things on my own. So I pursued these objectives pro se. And around this time, I had already I had acquired my education. I had got a legal certificate in legal research. So, after I went through a process of grounding myself on that level, I had begun to pursue these objectives, and as a individual without an attorney. And I had mixed petitions, so I had to go back and do a collateral attack, and then from there I went to the federal courts. That was denied. And basically, that's when, I looked to the future and I couldn't see nothing but darkness. So I had to look for alternative approaches to try to overturn this case instead of relying on the traditional appeal process. I did things. I wrote letters out to organizations, groups all around the country, all in the areas that I lived in. I had petition for executive clemency that was denied. I had sought out legal assistance from innocent networks, because at that time they were developing because of the DNA evidence
Yes.
that was present. So now that we had developed a, they had the, discovered a new science that can look at evidence with that type of persistency and determine if there's evidence of sexual assaults or rape or blood that's found at crime scenes that can connect people to these crime scenes. So I pursued those objectives, and there was a lot of roadblocks from the district attorney's office and even the police department in terms of me petitioning for under FOIA requests, trying to get these records so that I can look at the totality of all this evidence that may not have been brought out at
Yes.
trial.
It's incredible as you read the story, and in the book, Unshackling the Truth, Triumphant Over Just Injustice, you will see what Keith went through in all of these steps that he took. Was there a point when you thought, I thought this door was going to open, now it's closing? Were there any thoughts that, oh, this is just my fate, this is where I'm going to be? You seemed to grow a little stronger with each time that you were rejected.
I did, and it's because of the, it's because of really knowledge. I made an investment to educate myself. I was more so self-educated because I did a lot of that education, on my own, in the beginning stages. But I had, in my own self-education, I had basically stepped outside of the predicament in which I found myself in, because I could look at where I was at, and I can look at not only the fact that I was there and that there's no other way I can get out except through the courts, but I had to examine my alternatives. I had to look for other ways in which I can be creative enough to find, to help and to find the keys that I needed. So I was never pessimistic about not being able to, get out. I was fearful, but I wasn't pessimistic. But I always felt that, if I did die in prison, that I'm gonna die fighting, and that's the most I can give. That's the most anybody can give in any situation in which you find yourself. And I had to learn that through knowledge.
And you've gained that. It's such a remarkable thing. What you did, you were attacking the judicial system and educating yourself at the same time. A remarkable use of your time. The book by Keith Tyrone Bush is Unshackling the Truth. His website is unshacklingkeith.com. What were some of the factors that led your defense team to really go back and lead to the exoneration? What was it that finally connected that gave you the route to be exonerated?
Well, I had, I had, there was an innocent network over there in the New Jersey, Centeria Ministry, and I was working with them initially, and there were so many roadblocks, we just couldn't really get past what they were doing. And at some point, there was very little they can do about the case, so they had kind of let it go. And, I kept pursuing, and I looked at this DNA stuff, and I had found that Suffolk County had initiated a conviction, a review of old cases where they would look at these cases and determine if there's any evidence in there where there could be evidence to be tested for DNA. And I had, for like 6 years, I had wrote to the district attorney, practically begged them. I said, obviously you believe that I'm guilty of this crime. You convicted the world that I was guilty of this crime. Now I'm telling you, because there's a science that's exact. If there's any evidence, any physical evidence, because all the evidence points to that the victim had physically, you know, struggled with her attacker, but there was no evidence of rape. They didn't even do a rape kit, even though they charged me with attempted sexual rape. But I said, any evidence you have, I want you to test it against me. If you're saying that I'm guilty and I'm telling you I'm innocent, test it against me. And eventually, over a period of time, they agreed to look at the case, and they did find some biological material under the victim's fingernail scrapings. And then they contacted me and told me that they discovered it, and that if I give them my DNA, then that can be used not only in this crime, if there's that DNA matches with any crime other than that, I can be charged with that, and et cetera, et cetera. And I replied, you know, I thanked them. I replied, listen, it doesn't matter. You can test my DNA with any crime that ever been committed, any crime that will ever be committed in this crime. I'm not worried about that, because you're not going to find my DNA. All I want you to do is proceed with the process. So they agreed to proceed with the process. And around that time, I was in a struggle with the parole department. And then I got into it with the Department of Corrections. The parole department made it clear they wasn't going to release me. And then the Department of Corrections, they tried to retaliate against me for not basically admitting to guilt.
You know, that's interesting. You mentioned it was life, but with a reevaluation at 20 years, you would seem like the model prisoner. You're defending yourself because you were innocent. You went to school. You didn't create any problems. You were just trying to get that exoneration. Why did they keep denying you parole? How did that happen? What was their justification? The fact that you wouldn't admit to it?
Well, first of all, I wasn't the model prisoner. I had grown into the realization that, you know, oppression is unacceptable.
Yes.
And that if anybody oppresses, I don't care if it's an institution, an individual, or a group, that you have a right to rebel. And I had participated in a lot of prison movements and prison activities, because I kind of understood that from the point of the criminal justice system, they had no intentions of ever releasing me. So I didn't know if I was going to ever get out of prison or not, but I wasn't going to sit back and accept my oppression as if, you know, it's just something I had to accept, because most people said, well, you know, you can't beat the system. It came a point where I had to admit to guilt just to be considered for release on parole. And most people in the prison thought I was crazy for not even considering that. And I just, in my mind, I felt like I am not gonna let these people do to me as a kid, to try to do to me as a man. And I'm not gonna let them bring me into submission. So whatever I had to do to hold my position and to fight, I was willing to do it. So I wasn't the model prisoner in that sense. I wasn't the prisoner that was going around getting involved in trouble, and I didn't have none of them problems.
Yes.
I was just basically trying to fight for my freedom and to educate myself.
You did beat the system. Talk about when you found out that this was going to be successful. You get out of prison. You have the full exoneration. What was that like for you? Culmination of literally decades of fighting the system.
Well, you know, you got to understand that there came a point where there was really nothing left, you know. So when you reach that bottom, you hit that bottom, you know, when you look forward or you look in your future and you don't see nothing but darkness, you know, there comes a point when that happens. But we basically went back to the beginning. of the case. And we looked at everything in the case. We started with the scientific evidence presented by the prosecution. We found out that this confession that they wrote is impossible, that the way it's being described, because it's inconsistent with the facts of the murder of the deceased. And so this whole thing about her being killed a certain way and being stabbed a certain way, that it went against the scientific evidence. We also found out that, you know, a scientific opinion of fibers matching, similar fibers matching a jacket and the fingernail scrapings was unscientific. It was junk science, but you had experts giving an opinion that this fiber actually matched my jacket that I was wearing on the night of the party, when that's not even possible for him to make a statement like that. The expert witness, the doctor, Dr. Edelman, he testified that this pick matched the puncture wounds in the victim's lower back, when that was impossible, because we had new doctors, new scientists today, and they're saying, like, listen, that there's no way in the world that should even went to trial on those bases, because these facts are totally inconsistent. In addition to that, we had petitioned the court. We have really petitioned the police department for a complete file of our records. We have been denied that, so we had dropped a lawsuit on the police department because they were going to the extent of denying us that. At the time, the district attorney, Thomas Bodo, well, he's convicted now. He's a convicted attorney, district attorney. He was overseeing my case, and he was roadblocking it. He was preventing this information from coming out. Once he got convicted and someone else came into power, which is Tim Sweeney, that's when they said, listen, we went through this stuff here, and they started reviewing the stuff, and they sent me papers. Now, the papers they sent me first from the police department, the papers that some of the stuff they sent me was blacked out. So we didn't know what it was. We just know there was something involved, and there was somebody that got a polygraph test around 5 months after I was arrested. That person was being investigated by the district attorney and the detectives that was involved in assaulting me and prosecuting me. They took a secret statement from him and had him do a couple polygraph tests, and basically they hid that, you know, for like 44 years. This guy testifies that he was at the party, he was pissy drunk, he left the party. On his way to his sister's house, he went across through a wooded area and bumped and fell over a body, what he said was a body, and he had got up and ran home to his sister's house. And so this was around the same time that the crime occurred. And they never disclosed this information to the defense, because if they would have investigated it at that time, you know, even with the DNA and everything, they could have made connections. But if they would have investigated it, then they could have actually solved the crime. But instead of them going back and admitted what they did to me was wrong, because I already made it public that they assaulted me and forced me to sign this statement, they chose to bury it. And I thought it was personal. And then I find out later on that it's way deeper than that. But they chose to bury that information for 44 years. And they just basically left me stranded. So now when the district attorney gets, Thomas Spoto, when he gets arrested and he goes to prison, a new district attorney comes in. We make a request to the district attorney's office for a complete copy of the files. And they send us the files. And when they send us the files, we find out who the name of this person has blacked out of the police files and more details. We get the statement of the person and all that. And once we had that information, then it became clear to us that they were hiding an essential piece of information, you know, that collaborated
yes.
with all the other stuff we were discovering so far, because the prosecution witness who recanted, she finally admitted that the police had pressured her and threatened her to say and do what she did. And then we found out that there were other witnesses who were threatened and intimidated, especially witnesses in my behalf, because their whole intentions were to throw the case on me now that they had it on me and at all costs. You know, so when we started discovering these things, that's when the picture started to become clearer. I knew from, especially with the John Jones stuff and the expert witnesses, even expert witnesses on the issue of confessions of minors, that all the evidence pointed to the fact that this is a clear case of exoneration.
It's such a chilling story, how this could happen for so long and then finally right itself. Our guest is Keith Tyrone Bush. He is the author of the book. The book's available wherever books are sold. The book is Unshackling the Truth, Triumphant Over Injustice. Keith's website is unshacklingkeith.com. A couple minutes left in the program. Are there lawsuits? I know you had a lawsuit when you were in prison. Any lawsuits coming out of this for keeping you behind bars for over three decades?
Well, I actually challenged the Department of Correctional Services. They had moved me out of the maximum security. I was involved in the prison movement over there. We were doing a study on the criminal justice system, and we were finding out some alarming issues about the criminal justice system, particularly in its relationship to the Black and Latino communities. And we had met with legislators, community leaders, and so they moved me out to them. They reclassified me and a few other guys, and they moved the key players out of the system. They moved me to a medium status. And that medium status subject me to a policy that mandated that I take a sex offenders program as a consideration for release, but as because of the nature of attempted sexual abuse conviction. And that policy mandates that, and if you refuse, they move you further away from home as possible as a form of punishment. And I didn't have a problem taking any type of program as a requirement for release, because I took just about every program in the prison system. I created programs, I taught and facilitated programs, and you know, any information I acquire is something I can use to help somebody else or to help myself, whether
yes.
I'm understanding it or I'm bringing myself, you know, to you know, something like to that effect. But the key thing to it is that I think I just had to keep fighting. For me, it was to keep fighting. And when they put that restriction on me, you know, I wrote right to the commission and I explained to him that my situation is different. You know, I did not testify to being innocent. I mean, guilty. I did not, and I don't mind taking a program as a requirement for release, but I'm not taking no program that mandates an admission of guilt. That was the problem with the program. And I asked them if they're not going to consider that to send me back to a maximum facility where it wouldn't apply, because the parole board had no intentions of releasing me. At that time, I had appeared before the parole board like four times. So
amazing.
That translated into almost, I was going in, I had a 20-year consideration, and I ended up doing over 32 years because they kept denying me because I wouldn't admit to guilt. I wouldn't admit to guilt. And because of the nature of the crime that they knew couldn't change. And I wouldn't take a sex offender program because that required an admission of guilt.
Yes.
So that put me in that bind. And I went into the courts. What I did is I went into courts and I argued that the Department of Correctional Services is violating my constitutional rights for upholding my faith in God. And I told them that I testified in 1976. And when I testified, I raised my right hand and I swore before God and before the Holy Bible, right, to my testimony. And I said, by doing so, you have taken my testimony and you have made it a sacred oath. You made me accountable to my creator, since, you know, and I quoted in the commandments
oh,
and
yes.
all that, that God shall, he says out of his own mouth, thou shalt not use the name of thy God in vain, for he will not hold him guiltless who uses his name in vain. And I explained to them that God is my ultimate judge, and that's why God's name sits over the head of the judge of the court. And for you to violate my right to hold sacred and to hold my testimony before God in God's name, then you're infringing upon my right to religion. But because this issue was never really brought before the courts before, I think it kind of threw them off.
Yes.
And we had passed summary judgment. When you do a federal lawsuit, summary judgment, the judge determines that there is merit, there is an issue there that needs to be reviewed. And once we passed that summary judgment, I had proceeded in formal porpoise, and they had gave me an attorney. And that's when the attorney he was saying, well, Keith, they really want to have a conversation with you because, I don't think they really want this issue really come out because this could also affect other people, et cetera, et cetera. And at that time I was still pursuing these legal battles, but that's around the time that I had contacted a woman, Adele Bernhard. She was with the Pace University, and she had the Innocent Project over there. And I kind of explained some of where I was at that point. And she said, well, matter of fact, just let me regress 1 minute that once I submitted my DNA, I never heard from them. And since I never heard from them, I contacted my attorney I had at trial and asked if he can, check with the district attorney's office and find out what was the results of the DNA, because they didn't respond. So someone that contacted me from the district attorney's office said, oh, we're still looking at it. Soon as we get a decision, you will know, but you go to the parole board and you will be released, in a letter they sent to me. So I'm looking, and I didn't go to the parole board yet, but I was scheduled to go to the parole board my sixth time in November.
Keith, I got about two minutes left here in the program. I'm sorry.
Okay, I just wanted to, I'll just close it out by saying that Adele Bernhard had came into the case, and when she came into the case, that's when we really began to start to get the work done that we needed to get done to get exonerated.
What a frightening story, a story of resilience, transformation, persistence, what Keith went through for 4 decades of battling this, and the full exoneration he got May 22nd in 2019. The book is a fascinating read. It gives you an inside glimpse at the legal system, the criminal justice system. The book is Unshackling the Truth, Triumphant Over Injustice. Keith Tyrone Bush, our guest on the program. His website is unshacklingkeith.com. Keith, a pleasure having you on the program. So much more we can talk about, and would love to do that at a later time. Time went by too quickly. It's a remarkable story that you're sharing, helping other people caught in similar circumstances. Thank you so much for being with us on the program.
Thank you very much, Rick. I enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure. Keith Tyrone Bush, our guest on the program. I'd like to thank Gotham Books, Inc. for arranging our conversation. Gotham Books, bringing good books to life. You'll find their information available at GothamBooksInc.com. Information on the program, Keith's website is UnshacklingKeith.com. More information on our website, ThisWeekInAmerica.us. And we're back on today's program right after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.